yo, it's the legendary DJ Marley Marl.
Alongside Kali Bond.
Right now you're checking out the Legendized Podcast. On this podcast, we go beyond the origin stories of hip-hop's greatest artists.
And producers, and the classic records they made.
That's what's up. And yo, it's the legendary DJ Marley Marl.
Alongside DJ Kali Bond.
And this is what?
Legendized. Episode 4, Marley.
Episode 4 already. Woo! Wow, that's crazy, man. Yo, we getting so much response off of episode 1.
Yes.
And 2.
And 2.
And after that, ooh, it might be a little naughty in there.
Yeah. Woo.
Yes, yes, yes.
Check this out.
Yeah.
Hot Topics.
What's going on, man?
Almost a year anniversary. The year anniversary of Versus.
Wow.
They started in March 2020, pre-pandemic.
Yes.
Official in April of 2020.
Yes.
Let's talk about some of the acts that you think. There were Swiss Beatz and Timbaland.
Right, right. I remember that one. That was like the very first one then.
Yeah,
yeah. Yep. And they redid it too.
Yeah, yeah, that's what we're talking about today, because I figured since they revisited it.
Well, they might as well, you know, because now they're getting sponsored, there's checks involved. Now, I would have redid it too. I would have took your ass right in the studio.
Because it started off, there was supposed to be 2 10-song rounds.
Right.
And it just went left. And when Primo RZA came on board.
Yeah, that was a dope one.
What about your boys, Teddy Riley and Babyface?
Oh, hold up, man. Teddy Riley came out with the marching band and the lights and the dances and the sound was whack.
Yo, the coolest award goes to Babyface.
Babyface, he does win the coolest.
A flute of champagne.
He just does.
And acoustic guitar.
He was as cool as Mr. Big was.
Yes.
Him and Mr. Big is the coolest ones.
Earth, Wind & Fire versus the Isis.
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Big was like really, really, really dope. The DMX and Snoop was like so on time.
R.I.P. to the dogs.
You know who was a sleeper?
Ooh.
The Gladys Knight and the Patti LaBelle one.
Yeah,
that was a sleeper right there.
I think my personal favorite was Bounty Killer and Beanie Man, because they were both in the same room and they sparked that.
Because
that was a lot of energy.
Yeah, yeah. Yo, SWV and Escape though. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
They was putting hits on all night.
Yeah,
every song for the whole 2 hours was hits back to back. I was like, y'all forgot, you know, that made me fall in love back with Escape again.
Oh.
Because Biggie fucked me up. Y'all was fucked up behind Biggie, baby.
Yeah.
But after that, I had started hearing the music again and started realizing how dope Escape really was.
Yeah.
They had joints. That's somebody's childhood right there.
Now, one of the verses that did the most numbers that kind of threw me off was the Brandy and Monica joint.
But you got to think about it. Those are two made women.
Yes,
right there.
The ladies.
They are made.
Yes.
They are made. Like, that's all I got to say.
Bosses.
They bosses.
Yeah.
Bosses. But seriously, they made. So I expect those numbers to be extra high. Even if they wasn't that many people watching this, them numbers going to be high because those are two bosses right there.
Red and
Meth was cool. I expected more.
You did?
I don't know why. I expected more.
It was
more
only
hype.
Like a mini concert.
Yeah, but I expected like more hype and all of that. Because that's like Red and Meth, you know. I guess everybody that started watching and started smoking with them in the beginning and was too smoked out and tired at the end. So I don't know if everybody saw the end of that one.
Now, is there anyone that you would like to see?
I would like to see.
Because I have the banger. I have the banger version.
I would like to see Fat Jiddo.
Fat Joe.
Snoop or something like that.
Well, Snoop already went.
Yeah.
What about Fat Joe and 50? Because you know they had beef.
Though, that'd be crazy. That'd be crazy.
One of the ultimate one?
I know.
You already know what I'm going to say? You
50 and Ja Rule.
Nah. Well, that'd be dope.
50 and Ja Rule.
But I got one bigger than that.
What's that?
I want everyone's attention in the room.
What's that?
I want all the listeners to like stop right now.
Because
right, I need it? You to help promote this.
What's that?
Dr. Dre versus Marley Marl.
That'd be crazy.
Please. Oh, you should see the response in the room right now.
That'd be crazy.
Is that crazy?
That'd be crazy. Because easy.
Don't we need that? Them both in the same room to see the architects in the same room?
And what are we going to do? Put LL against Snoop, you know, in that fight?
Listen.
What are we going to do?
Name two songs that you would save for like the end of your verses.
cheesy rap, nigga. I save I do cheesy rat on a nigga. Blah!
Ah, see? Could you think about the Chronic.
Right.
In Control.
Right.
Think about the catalog from Eminem to 50. Then think about Kane, G-Rap, Shante, Shan, Biz, Craig G, Ace. Do I need... And
a Little Rock
Jay-Z,
Kim in
there,
Little Rock Kim,
you know? And
you know something.
If you hear me out there, blow up the IG wherever Dr. Dre versus Marley Marl on a Versus. Season 2 for Versus.
Blah.
Holla at me, Swiss.
The beginning.
Yeah, I'm available, Timbaland. We can make this happen. Not a problem. Something else monumental happened.
What happened?
In history.
What's going
on?
The
groundbreaking of the Universal Museum of Hip Hop.
Wow.
Founded by Rocky Bucano.
Okay.
In the BX.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people were there, like Nas, Naughty by Nature, Lil' Kim, Fat Joe, Flash, Slick Rick, EPMD, the Assembly Speaker, the Borough President, Mr. Diaz Jr. It's more than just a hip-hop museum. It's also a complex project being built.
Okay.
How do you feel about that museum?
I think it's definitely needed. You know what I'm saying? It's definitely needed.
It is enlightening. I'm ecstatic. I'm excited. I'm just hoping that it's curated right.
No doubt. I don't want to be like Washington. And I went out to Washington. I was like, yo, hold up. I was a little disappointed.
In the music section of the Black History Museum in D.C., right? In the DMV.
Right.
There's a nice little hip-hop section.
They got Mr. Magic. They got like
a little blurb in a 2x2 box, yeah, about BLS and Mr. Magic.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw my name on the wall and like a little sticker, something on that. So I was like,
yeah, they didn't really, I appreciate that and all, but I just hope that since this is the Universal Museum of Hip Hop, that it's really curated right. And
no doubt.
And like a lot of the history and the eras are correctly represented.
Well, I think it would be. I mean, because to be honest, I mean, no disrespect to Ninth Wonder, but when I went to the other shit, I saw like Ninth Wonder doing some sampling class.
It is an interactive.
And I'm like, bro, he wasn't sampling. So why is he up there? Why don't he got Premier, P-Rock,
you,
or me, or somebody? You know, no disrespect, but you know, y'all got to get it right because this is history y'all writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, no disrespect to Ninth, but he was using Fruity Loops.
Well, we do have Curtis Blow.
Right.
Bambaataa, Grand Wizard Theodore.
Right.
Your boy, Mikey Benson.
Right.
Joe Conzo.
Okay.
And Melly Mel.
You're right.
Is a part of the founding members. So we should be able to get things pretty accurate.
It should be.
If it's going to be Universal, I want to see some, you know, I want to see Derek B up in there.
Okay.
You know, UK's Derek B.
No doubt.
He contributes. You know, UK has a lot to offer. So I'm just hoping that I'm wishing the best.
I'm wishing the best. That's real talk. I'm seeing the name Universal Music Museum of Hip Hop, and I'm seeing back in the day, used to say the Universal Zulu Nation.
Zulu
so
Nation.
I wonder how close it really is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because some people don't want to get down with that just off the fact. And, you know, we'll just leave it as that.
Because we don't want to, yeah, exactly. So we wishing the best for the hip-hop museum and support it. That's where hip-hop is going nowadays.
That's where it is.
Getting our own museum.
That's what it is. In the BX.
Where the Mecca.
The Mecca.
The foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people say that the ATL is the Mecca right now. Love to the ATL, though. Love to the ATL because they're doing their thing.
In this segment of the game, we're gonna find out who chopped you.
Hi-ya! What the hell?
This is the part of the show right here where we legendize a sample, brother.
Time for who chopped ya?
Ding, 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 ding.
That's not Mardi Gras. Let me tell you, hold up. It's not Mardi Gras.
Not. Check this out. This episode's sample is considered one of the top five most sampled loops ever.
It ain't JB?
Nah.
Okay.
Over 5,000 songs God were sampled.
Damn, I wish I owned part of that pub.
Yes, indeed. They are called the Winstons.
Okay.
Amen, Brother.
Ooh.
Produced by Don Carroll in 1969.
1969? Top five most sampled.
Yeah, and it goes a little something like these. A drum loop.
Ooh, that sounds familiar.
Real familiar.
Ooh, hold up. I think my boy MC Shan, who was on this show a few weeks ago.
Episode one.
I think he sampled that with Informer. Let's hear Informer and find out where he put that.
What's up, man?
Hey, yo,
what's up? What's going on, yo? Sick and tired of on the block, you know what I'm saying? Yo, still, they came around looking for you the other day.
Word,
bust it.
Let me be.
Informer.
Wow, MC Shan wow. used that.
You feeling that?
Yeah, when I first heard that, I was like, yo, Shan got a winner. He got a winner. He'd probably be getting paid for the rest of his life off that. That's real talk,
right,
man.
Right. You know who else used it?
Who else used that?
Dr. Dre and DJ Yella in 88. NWA's Straight Outta Compton.
Get out of here.
When something happens in South Central Los Angeles, nothing happens. It's just another big and dead.
Straight Outta Compton, crazy motherfucker named Ice Cube. From the gang called Niggas With Attitudes. When I'm called off, I got a sawed off.
That be hard.
Woo!
That be hard right there.
I like the way the production of NWA, because you can tell a lot of work went into it, because they was chopping up different joints all throughout the song.
Let me tell you, the first time I heard an NWA record, Craig G let me hear. He's like, yo, Marley, check this shit out. And he put it on and they was cursing up a fucking storm. He was letting me hear it in the radio station. And I was like, yo, that's taboo. We can't play none of that shit. But it's dope.
That particular drum loop, I was like, oh, mm-hmm. East Coast flavor.
Then in 1992, Eric Berria and Rakim.
What?
Used it on Casualties of War.
Ooh.
Remember that? Here we go, right here.
Bye. Ooh.
Casualties of War.
Whoa, that was
Whoa,
tight.
Drum loop.
Crazy.
You
right
wanna know
there.
Who else used it?
Who else used that?
You used it when you made my demo.
Ooh.
But I didn't bring a sample of that.
Aww.
Let's keep it moving.
Ooh. So guess what? That sample right now
yeah.
has been what?
Legendized.
Boom!
Legendized.
It's about time to bring in the artist of this episode.
Oh, yes.
Right,
yeah, let's get to it.
Let's take it to the artist for this episode, Caliban.
Another legendary guest. He grew up in Far Rockaway, Queens.
Facts.
Former member of Third Base and Nonfiction.
Mm.
Facts.
Executive producer of Nas Illmatic.
And it was written, don't get it twisted.
Okay, and it was written, let's not get it twisted. Also helped cultivate the legendary rapper OC.
Facts.
I mean, we can talk about his resume is very long. Searchlight Music, hosted radio in Detroit. Marley, who are we talking about?
None other than my boy MC Search. What up, Marley?
I'm good, man. Good to hear your voice, brother. How are you?
We good, man. Welcome to Legendize, man. You know, this is where we get with the artists and we talk about what really fucking happened.
Yeah, what really makes them a legend.
That's what I'm saying. So number one, man, how you been, brother?
I'm really feeling good, man. I love where everything is right now. I love where, you know, the culture is headed. Mm-hmm. You know, I love what we're doing in the space right now in terms of creating storytelling, not only of our peers, but of our icons, and just creating opportunities for those artists that paved the way and doing it in a way that is different and new and just sounds amazing.
No doubt, no doubt. That's what's up, man. Did you ever think hip hop would take you this far?
In the words of Rappin' Duke, da ha, da ha, I never thought that hip hop would take it this far. Oh, that was B.I.G. honestly, I must have had some idea, because, you know, I was faced with a decision at the time when I was in high school, where I had to either go, I had a full scholarship to go to St. Louis School of Music, and or stay in New York and chase my dream. And I remember sitting around the Shabbos table on a Friday night with my mom. And Monday I had to sign my contract and to go to school.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, Mom, I'm not going to school. I'm going to be a rapper.
Wow.
He said, what do you mean? You're going to wrap gifts at Sears? You're going to wrap gifts at Sears? Like, what do you mean you're going to be a rapper? You know, Vashnist rapper, you know, Yiddish, the whole thing. I said, no, there's this whole thing coming up in New York. You know, guys are doing, they're writing on walls and they're dancing on the floors and there's DJs and there's other part of the culture. There's rap and there's the Fearless Four and the Cold Crush. And she said, what kind of crazy not? I said, Mom, I'm telling you, just got to, you know, trust me. And she said, what's your plan? I said, I told you my plan. I'm going to be a rapper. What do you mean? What's my plan? I just told you. She said, no. You got to have a plan. And she made me write out this plan, and I followed my plan.
So, yo, let's go back, man. Let's go back to the young Michael Barron. You grew up in a neighborhood in Far Rock. What was the neighborhood?
It was Far Rockaway. It's Far Rockaway, Queens. There was no other area. It was Almont Road, and it was right on the border of Inwood, Long Island, and Far Rockaway, like Beach 9th Street.
On Beach 9th. See, I don't even know where on the, like, scale.
Right,
of on
I was
the
right
nine,
around the corner.
60s,
yeah, right around the corner from
40s.
Right, I was right around the foot. No. It wasn't like Auburn or Edgemere. It was like,
here we go.
True, right. Far Rockaway. It was right around the corner from Red Fern Projects.
Okay.
It was right down the block from PS197. So I was near Auburn and Wavecrest.
So it's still hood over there too.
Oh yeah. No, it was always hood. It was always hood.
Yeah, no doubt.
I was getting my ass whooped every day.
Okay. Because I just wanted to ask you, why can't people call you a culture vulture?
No.
Yeah. Why can't? Yeah. Why can't?
I don't.
You lived it, right?
I mean, I guess technically you can. I mean, I guess you can, right? Like, because this was a culture that was not for me. And I was told when I first started being interested in it that I could, you know, watch it, but it was not for me.
Mm.
And I guess technically you could call me whatever you want to call me. I think that for me, my hope is that my contributions to the culture, the fact that I did not ever take advantage of any artist that I worked with or dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
I treated people fairly.
Gotcha.
That people were treated ethically around me.
Gotcha.
And that everything that I did with the highest integrity and ethos around the tenets of hip hop, which are peace, unity, love, and having fun, which is what was taught to me.
No doubt.
But even
those are the reasons why I wouldn't be a culture vulture. I still think people might call me that because I'm white, but, you know, that's on them. I can't carry your burden.
Right. And not only that, they could only say that not knowing his history.
Yeah, because he lived it.
Right, he lived it. Take us back to when you were first emceeing and breakdancing and feeling the whole hip-hop vibe. Where did the origin of MC Search come from?
Yeah.
So I was, when I was in middle school, IS-53, Brian Piccolo, it was around the time my friends' government names were all changing. They were going from Gregory to Lord Duquan.
Okay.
And Thomas to mathematics.
Oh, okay, but the 5% Nation.
My man Henry became understanding. And they were all getting knowledge of self.
Okay.
And I was this Jewish kid who thought he was going to be a rabbi. Like, I thought I was either going to be a cantor or a rabbi.
Okay.
And I just asked a lot of questions. I would ask all these questions like, yo, why did you change your names? And what do you mean the 1 to 10s? And why is it so important you need to know the distance from the sun to the, you know? They were like, why are you always searching for the answers? Why are you always searching for the answers? Like, searching for the answers. And I was with a homegirl of mine who her graffiti name was Too Cute. And I was telling her about that. And I kept saying how my friends kept saying, she was like, oh, that'd be dope. You should write that. That should be your name, Search. Like, you should write that. Like, because I was thinking about tagging and graffiti.
Right.
And so I started writing my name, S-E-A-R-C-H, but I never really liked it because it looked like a word. Mm. It didn't look like a name. And my homeboy, Kevon Moore, for my 16th birthday, got me my first nameplate belt buckle.
Wow.
Marley had money like this, but I'll explain. I'm going to break it down to you, Callie.
Please, please do.
I'm going to break it down.
Please.
So, right. So, the five-lettered nameplate belt buckle, that was $35 just for the frame, right? And it, and this is 1985 now. And then each letter was $5.
Mm.
But the six-letter joint, that was $55.
Mm.
So if you had 50 plus six letters, that was $85, not including the $15 for the leather belt.
Was that gold or the silver?
Because no, silver.
Okay,
no,
the silver was crazy.
The gold didn't make it out to Queens.
All right,
y'all,
all right.
Y'all were playing with the gold in Brooklyn. We didn't have the gold in Queens.
We had the silver, no doubt. We had the stainless. Jamaica Ave, right there.
So my man, Kev, he didn't have the money for the $55 joint. So he got me the $35 joint, but he tried to squeeze in S-E-A-R-C-H into the five joint, and the A fell out. And when the A fell out, I realized that there were these little teeth in the letters, like above and below the letters. There were these little grooves that fit into
right,
the frame.
Right. They kept it in still.
So then I put S-E-R-C-H, and I'm like, damn, that looks dope. That looks fresh.
Mm.
And that's how it became Search. So that's how my name became MC Search.
Legendized.
So who was one of your early mentors back in the day? Like, as you were sitting in Far Rock, like, who inspired you to really want to do it?
So the thing that was really cool in Far Rockaway was we weren't really getting a lot of the tapes from like Brooklyn or the Bronx. So I wasn't really hearing Cold Crush or Kaz in 78 or 79. Like, the crew that really we heard, me and my friends heard, was this crew out of Brooklyn called the Kango Crew.
Cause I'm a Ricky D in the place to be. I turn on my mic cause I love to MC. And when I'm on the go, I like to terrorize the show. Because I'm down with a crew that called the Kango. And we steal the show. Gotcha.
We would always hear the Kango
Classic
Crew. The Hillbilly Girl, Indian Girl. Like, I knew all of those routines. Like, I knew Indian Girl, like, verbatim, right?
Just as I know the one the girls be talking about. Yeah, must be, because we look like a winner. Come to my house, discuss it over dinner. I met a father, Big Chief Beretti. I said, what's for dinner? Smoked spaghetti. Dinner was rotten. Thought I was going to cook it. Never would have took it if I knew that he had cooked it later on. Max.
So my first day in high school, I didn't go to high school in Far Rockaway. I went to the High School of Music and Art in Harlem. Mm. So well, I used traveling. To have to take the A train from Mott Avenue.
Whew.
All the way to 135th Street, right? Take the A train to 125th, hop on the 1, and go to 135th.
Hour and a half,
go
easy.
Go up St. Nicholas, right? 2 hours, 22 minutes, right?
2 hours. These are 2 hours. Right.
2 hours, 22 minutes. So I get into music and art, and I go into the lunchroom for orientation.
Oh, music and art, okay.
And I hear these dudes in a little cypher. At the time, I didn't know it was called a cypher. But they were just all these, and I hear these dudes, and they're doing Hillbilly Girl.
Mm.
And I couldn't see him. I just get up on a table and I turn to my homeboy at the time, who is we had a Big Brother program in music and art. It's my man, Stephen Bosco. May he rest in peace. Mm. I said, Steve, they're doing the Kango Crew routine, the Hillbilly Girl. I thought it was cool because I'm a white boy that knows Kango Crew.
Mm.
And he goes, motherfucker, that is the Kango Crew. And it was Ricky D, Dana Dane, Lance Romance,
right,
and Omega, who later became Slick Rick and Dana Dane. And then there was this other dude, this white boy named Vanilla B.
Mm.
And that was the first white rapper ever in New York. Vanilla B, a.k.a. Keo, a.k.a. Lord Scotch, a.k.a. Blake Lethem. He was the first white rapper. So seeing those dudes and then seeing J. Cool from the Fresh 3 MCs 5 years before he put out F-R-E-S-H.
Wow. Fresh, fresh, fresh.
Yo, that's fresh.
But I needed something new that I can wear because I'm F-R-E-S-H. Fresh, fresh, fresh. Yo, that's fresh. F-R-E-S-H. Fresh, fresh, fresh. Yo, that's fresh.
And then going to school with them and Lord Turu from the Eternal Force and like all of these dudes who became legends.
You was amidst all
and
of
I'm
them.
And I'm like in school with them. Like that, those were my, those. So when my first record came out in 85, I sounded like a wannabe Slick Rick. I was rhyming in a fake English accent because I was so like blown away by what these dudes were doing, you know?
Yes.
So yeah, man, that was it. And not only that, like now I'm going back to Far Rockaway. So the funny story is, Marley, I gotta share this story with you. Funny story is that same lunchtime, Ricky D starts doing this in 1980, now I'm talking about. He starts doing this routine with this guy next to him named Dougie Fresh, who is beatboxing,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
And they start doing this thing called Lottie Dottie, right? So by the end of like December 1980, I knew every word to Lottie Dottie. So I'm going back from 135th Street in Convent to Far Rockaway, and I'm fronting like Lottie Dottie's my lyrics, trying to impress girls.
Okay, okay.
So I'm like, anytime I'm trying to kick it to a female, I'm like, yo, you want to hear me rhyme? And I'd be like, Lottie Dottie, I like to party. Okay. I don't cause trouble. I don't bother nobody. I'm just a man that's on the mic. And I'm like, right, so I'm kicking it to these badass Dominican chicks. And they're like, ooh, he's so cute, that white boy rhyming, right? So this in 1985, record comes out.
Oh, wow.
I'm at Hot Skates in Lynbrook. I go to McDonald's. Dominican chick I'm dating, she's giving me free burgers and fries. Red Alert's on in the spot, and the record comes on. Red Alert's playing it, right?
Lottie Dottie.
And
Ricky, 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 can't you see? Somehow your words just hypnotize me. And I just love your jazzy ways. Oh, MC Rick, my love is here to stay. And on and on and on, she kept on.
And the girl goes, oh, this Slick Rick, and points at me. And I turn around. thinking that she's talking to the dude behind me. And he's like, yo, that white boy ain't fucking Slick Rick. Blows up my spot. I boogied out of there. Yeah. I never bit another rhyme again. That was it. I was done biting rhymes. But I couldn't believe that some of the things that Rick was saying in 1980 made The Great Adventures of Slick Rick, like became Lottie Dottie.
Wow.
Like
a classic.
Like, I knew that record in like 1980. Like J. Cool's lyrics from the Fresh 3 MCs. And F-R-E-S-H, like, those were rhymes he was saying in ciphers in, like, 82 and 83, you know?
Wow. That's
so history. It was really amazing to me. Like, even the Fearless Four, Problems of the World Today, one of the girls I went to school with, this girl, Nichelle, dated one of the dudes from the Fearless Four. So he would come by the school all the time pumping music. So I knew all this stuff. So I was going back to Far Rockaway being, like, the king of hip-hop.
Yeah, because
you know, being white, but still like, oh, you ain't up on the field. There's four problems in the world today. That girl over there got the fair money status, but she's always taking someone stands her back. She needs someone to text someone likely as a parent, but being ignored. She's a kleptomaniac.
Right.
I mean, I'm still remember all these rhymes, you know what I mean? Wow. To this day. So anyway.
So after that, did you start Nonfiction?
Oh, nah. Nonfiction, Third Base came first. And then we did Nas. I did Illmatic, and it was written. And then I was at Wild Pitch. I did, you know, OC. I did Word Life. And then I left Wild Pitch, and then I met Ill Bill. Mm. And Ill Bill and his brother Necro.
Okay.
And then we formed Nonfiction. Yeah. In fact, it was Ill Bill who introduced me to Mark Echo, and that's how I met Echo, and that's how I helped build Echo Unlimited Clothing.
So Nonfiction, we used to always play that.
We played on Future Flavors. Search, I want to take it back just for a second. Why did you not end up starting off with a solo deal before you went down the road with Third Base?
I did. I did start with a solo. So I had two independent solo records. One was on Warlock called Melissa.
Just to kiss her, but she was online and her name was Melissa. I was walking alone on Fifth Avenue, scrolling over to bones, just me and the crew.
Which was like a wannabe sounding slick Rick record. And there was another record I started. I did a, my mother gave me money for a label. And I started with Grand Wizard Tony D from the Bad Boys called Idlers. And I had a record called Hey Boy. So I had this record called Hey Boy, and the B-side was called Go White Boy. And we sampled the Play That Fucking Music, White Boy. So those two records were bumping in the quarters. They were bumping in Rooftop. Like, I was doing shows all through New York. And I was going to sign a solo deal. And that's when I met my old partner. And I decided at that point, like, even though I was already signed to Rush, I was already, like, going to probably sign this label or they were going to make me an offer. But something about my solo records didn't feel as right as the records I did with my old partner and my old group. It just felt better.
Oh,
so
okay,
I believed in what we did, and that's why I didn't ever do a solo deal.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, that makes sense. Gotcha. So you were signed to Rush Management before you got the deal?
Oh, yeah. So I was signed to Rush Management as an artist. And the thing that's crazy is that I had done 4 or 5 demos, and then A&M was coming to see me from L.A.
Ah.
And the night before they were coming to see me, the producer of Third Base, this dude Sam Seva, hit me. He's like, yo, I was just in the studio. You know, Dante Ross called me about this dude. Stood up in the studio, but the music that he was making is crazy. You got to hear it. And I said, okay, cool. But you know, like, A&M is coming to see us tomorrow. He's like, yeah, but you got to hear this. It's crazy. So I go into Sam's house, and there was this dude there that had made these tracks. And I heard him, and I was like, oh, these are crazy. They're crazy. And automatically started rhyming. We ran into Chung King. We wound up making 3 songs.
Wow, Chung King.
And then this dude from A&M came to see me. And he's like, yo, so, you know, we're excited about you, Search. It's either you or this kid, Prince Raheem from Houston. We're thinking about signing one of y'all. I said, well, listen, I'm not soloist anymore. I'm in a group. The group called 3 the Hard Way. Let me play you what we made last night. And I played him Words of Wisdom, Prog Me a Vomit, and Triple Stage Darkness.
Okay.
And he was like, eh, I don't really get the group thing. So this is like 1987.
Mm.
And as soon as that happened, Lior Cohen called the studio and was like, you know, he found out that A&M was going to pass on me because they wanted to sign a soloist. And Lior went crazy on me, kicked us all out of studio.
Get out of the studio. You are fired. Fuck you, Serge. You will never,
you know, he gave me that whole thing. Told me he was no longer representing me. He quit. I fucked up my career, this and that. He even called my mother. May she rest in peace.
You must talk to Michael. He is creating.
And my mother called me and was like, well, why can't the guy you just met be like your hype man? Like, why can't he be your hype man? I'm like, no, that's not the way it works, Ma. Okay. Like, we're a group. Like, we're all equal. You know, it's like, that's the way it works. And, it took us 2 years from that point to finally get signed to Def Jam and put out the Cactus album.
Wow. Now, see, that was a bit of history that we didn't know.
Legendize.
This is the story of how a film gets made. Starring Josh Rubin.
It's his first feature.
You Were the Worst's Aya Cash.
Can we not do this right now?
And SNL's Chris Redd.
He's not doing it for a paycheck.
Okay, I'll see y'all.
Join us for the making of Scare Me, a horror comedy from the brilliant mind of Josh Rubin.
This year you're gonna make a movie no matter what.
Tear down the fourth wall of filmmaking with our crack team of investigators.
Don't you come at me and try to get me to spill some stuff.
This is Make Cool Shit, hosted by Aaron Hieffetz.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Season 1, Make a Movie.
3, 2, 1.
Everywhere you enjoy podcasts.
So I guess I'm going to learn the film business.
legendized.
Yo, so your first tour, you put out the Cactus joint. You go on tour. Who's on this first tour? Tell us about the first tour.
So the first tour we ever went on was LL's tour. It was the Bigger and Duffer tour. And I was on tour with King's Son. Mm. It was us and De La Soul. De La Soul was in another bus. And it was all like these Rush artists, right?
Right. Oh, okay.
And one thing I remember was the guy who ran the tour was Al Haymon. Al Haymon did Budweiser Superfest, all of this. And he told King's Son every night, yo, you got 5 minutes. You got 5 minutes. The white boys got 5 minutes. You get on, get off, right? And like, I was afraid of Al Haymon. Like, he scared me. Like, the dude was like definitely like not playing around. It was all about LL. The levels were real low for us. LL's levels were real high. You know what I mean? we're going on stage in front of like 12 people. 10 of them worked there. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just happy to be out in New York and performing. But Son would go on before us. And Al Haymon told him, like, yo, say your piece. Because at 5:01, the lights are coming up and the mics are going off. So Son was a big dude. Like, King Son was a big dude.
Yeah, he was.
He was like, so he was like, yo, you know, whatever. So he'd go up, him and D Moet, he'd do Hey Love.
Wow, that's right.
And then he'd try to do like one other record. And Hey Love was already a long ass song.
Right.
Like,
hey, and it was a slow joint too, mellow.
Right. Like, and Marley remembers like records that we heard back in the day. You got through the verse and the chorus on his show, on Marley and Magic's show, because 2 hours, you had to play like 600 songs in 2 hours. Yeah, like, you know what I mean? Like, you were lucky if you got through a verse and a chorus.
Word.
So you never heard the whole Hey Love. Hey Love is like 17 minutes long.
Word, it's like 12
crazy minutes. Long record.
Put me through my eyes, behold the woman I'm looking for. It's you, you're the girl that I adore.
Hey Love, Hey Love.
So by the time he gets through the song, it's like 4:58. He's trying to do his second song, and they cut the mic on him, and they turn the lights on. So me and Arl, like, we know, get on, get off. We're going to do half a song, get on, get off. Mad professional. Tell everybody our name of our album, when it's coming out, on and off, on, right, off, right. On and off. Second night, Al Haymon, same thing. Son is trying to get two songs in. 5 minutes, lights come up. They shut it off. Yo, Son goes after Al Haymon. Like, goes after him. Like, yo, don't be turning the fucking mic off on me, blah, 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 right? Beefing. Meanwhile, we're trying to get on stage. By the time we get on stage,
you got like
and we
one
come
minute
off, on time, by the way, like 4:58, we're told we're getting sent home. Because Son fucked it up for us, and because Son had to split the cost of the bus with us, now we can't go on the tour anymore.
Right.
So we did two dates and then we came home.
Oh,
and
that was it. Okay.
That was our first tour. And then the second tour we went on was a lot more fun. That was like, so we went on, I'm sorry, I love this story. So we went on tour with Too Short in the Midwest, right?
Oh, wow.
So this is really dope. So I've been Too Short, you know, like, and I tell Short this all the time. I love Todd. But when I got on the road, And Marley, you both can relate to this. I'm from fucking New York. Fucking Oakland MC. Fuck anybody. I'm from fucking New York, right? And that's my attitude is like, outside of the five boroughs, it might as well not exist. The earth might as well be flat. Mm. Like, there's nothing outside the five boroughs. Like, maybe Baltimore, DC, whatever. But, you know, the world was flat. So I'm going on the road with Too Short, and we're opening for Too Short. So I'm like, okay, look, I don't know about this Too Short dude. I never heard Born to Mac. I don't know nothing about him. Mm. I just know that I'm going to kill shit every night.
Mm.
And I'm surprised, first off, that there's like 12,000 people coming to see us. That's first.
No
off
doubt.
Rip.
Okay.
Sold out, Too Short, Born to Mac tour, special guest, third base. I'm going out dancing. I'm jumping in the crowd. Crowd is kind of hyped, you know, feeling good. I'm doing the worm. I'm coming off tour, I'm sweating like an Egyptian slave. You understand me? Like, I'm sweating like I just laid bricks for a living. and I'm drinking water. And they say, ladies and gentlemen, Too Short. And the crowd goes crazy. And he just walks back and forth, slow as molasses,
right,
and just goes, bitch! And and the crowd goes apeshit. And I'm like, what the fuck is this magic? wait, what the fuck is this special sauce? So I figured maybe it was just the one city because we were in like Nebraska. So I'm like, okay, maybe he's got a following in Nebraska. How hard could that be? My man, we did 10 shows with this dude in 10 different cities and the crowds got bigger and all he had to do is go, bitch, and the crowd went crazy. And I felt some type of way about it, but I loved, me and Short became like, we became fast friends. We just became homies after that. But I also realized that the world was much bigger than New York. Right. And I better learn about it real fast.
It also expanded your fan base for third base. Am I correct?
Well, I mean, they weren't our fans. It was real clear. They were not our fans.
Right.
They were Too Short fans. We were there to support Too Short, but they were not third base fans. Like, it was very hard for me to wrap around my pea brain that people were not there for me and didn't know every single lyric that I was kicking. Like, how could you not know a third bass song? Like, I was insulted.
Right. You know rap, like, you don't know my shit. What the fuck is wrong with y'all niggas?
And Marley, with all due respect, with Magic, anytime Magic went into a room, it would be like, do you know who I am? Super rockin' Mr. Magic. Like, he would make himself known, and even if you knew who he was,
he'd throw the echo on like that too.
Yeah. super.
You know who the fuck I am?
I am.
Yeah.
Super.
He had the bomb. He hit the blast first.
So I was like, really, like, I felt some type of way. Like, I was tight because, like, I was like, yo, how do you not know third base? But the truth of the matter was, we were not that important. Like, you know, people had other tastes. People liked other things. And it wasn't really until the Taste of Chocolate album Kane's tour, that I started to really recognize we had a fan base.
Oh.
You know, like we started to really recognize that, like, people knew the words to our songs. People knew certain things about, like, inflections that we said on records because we would hear them. You know, it was just different. It was different things. But it was very, very hard to get my head around.
Speaking of things you said on record, do you ever think that you'll ever come to peace with MC Hammer?
Yeah, I think, here's the thing, again, that I've said it now a million times and a million and one times. Like, I'm not the guy who started the beef.
Okay.
Right.
My old partner said the line that he got really mad about. The sad part is, you know, that dude's really not in the space to really step up. So I'm the dude who gets
you the face
these
of the group
questions.
Kinda. You're the face of the group, kind of, like, you know.
You know, so now I'm left with this, but I will say this. We've shared spaces in Clubhouse recently. We've you know, for me and my personal well-being and where I am in my recovery and where I am in terms of making amends with people. Yeah, man. I mean, I think I have to, for my own mental health, come to terms with the fact that I need to see it from his perspective. It's not the gas face, what we think about Hammer, that people are upset about or that he's upset about. The line he's upset about is the line on the Cactus album where my old partner said the Cactus turned Hammer's mother out.
Exactly.
That's the line he's mad about, right?
Right.
But to me, when I was in the studio and I heard that, it was based on the fact that his album was called Turn This Mother
Turn
Out,
his mother
and our
out,
album
right.
was called The Cactus.
Right, right.
And to me, it was just lyrical wordplay. Like, that was our shit. We were lyricists.
Right. And
wordsmiths.
And
I wasn't thinking.
Yeah.
It was wordsmiths.
You know what I'm saying? So I wasn't thinking about it like my old partner was dissing his mom, because I love my mother. I've never disrespected somebody's mother, you know? And if I would have heard it that way, I would have said something.
Right.
Yeah.
I would have said, yo, my man, like, you know, no, I'm dead serious. I never in a million years thought that he would take that so literal. But then it goes back to what I'm saying. Like, he's from the Bay Area. The wordplay wasn't like that. He was a real, very simple, straight to the point type of artist.
Entertainer.
I was much more Kendrick Lamar type.
Right, right.
You know, I was much more Rakim type. Like, thought I was a donut, tried to glaze me. Like, I would never take that literally as like someone trying to glaze me with you know, melted sugar. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, like that would never be a literal lyric for me. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
like,
you...
So when that line got said by my old partner, I never thought in a million years old boy would take it like we're dissing his mother.
So yeah.
Like we're trying to, you know.
Yeah.
But yes, I would definitely be like, you know what? I take ownership in the fact that you misunderstood that. I understand why you got so upset. I don't understand why you put a hit out on us. Like, that's some other shit.
Yeah.
I understand why you would be so upset by that. Like, yeah. I get. Like, I understand that. And yes, I would definitely make peace with old boy because for me, and he could say, yo, fuck you. It's that cool. But for me, especially in my recovery and the fact that, you know, I'm coming up on 10 years clean and amends are a big part of my story.
Right. Respect
and making
that.
Amends with people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I would definitely make peace with old boy for sure.
Gotcha. So why did the group split up, Third Base?
It's really simple. I mean, it just was a very dysfunctional, immature.
But that's rap, though. That's rap. Come on, man.
Yeah,
that's
but
rap.
It's different. It's different. Like, it was just.
That's rap. Come on.
There were some things said that can't be unsaid.
I got you.
And there were some things done that can't be undone.
Did he hit your girl or something?
No, he didn't hit my girl, but he called my girl out a name. At the time, I was making very mature decisions as a very young man. I didn't have enough people around me to kind of help me with making such mature decisions.
I got you.
At the time, like I needed to just, you know, fall back, but I tried different times in different eras to put it back together and it wasn't going to happen.
I got you. So after that time, you switched. You turned into a talent scout and an A&R. Then you started working with OC. I remember back in the day, you was working with OC.
Yep.
And then Nas came out of nowhere and then you started working with Nas and, you know, thank you very much for being one of the saviors to Queensbridge. Thank you very much. Because we definitely needed that shot in the arm at that time.
That's very kind of you, man. I don't see it that way, but it's very humbling to hear you say that.
No, that's real talk, though. Real talk. We needed that shot at that minute. And, you know, the next generation had to come with it to show that, you know, what it really was. And, you know, you took the youngest talent from the hood that was baking at that time. You know what I'm saying? And what attracted you to Queensbridge, number one? What attracted you to Queensbridge?
I mean, it wasn't even Queensbridge. It was just Nas. I mean, Live at the Barbecue. I mean, that verse was just 1991, Maze Source, Breaking Adams. I mean, it was the most incredible verse.
That verse was the River Park, though.
Okay.
That was a park jam.
Yeah, I mean, he came to see me in the studio and he asked for my help. And how are you not going to help the, you know, it was so obvious he was going to be the greatest MC of our generation.
100%.
So how do you not help a young man like that? How do you not protect him from what you just went through with Russell and, you know, and dealing with, you know, making a really bad deal? So I just wanted to make sure that he didn't endure what I endured. And if he gave me the privilege and the honor to help him, that I was going to help him. And I was going to put him first, not put myself first or put my company first, but put him first and make sure he could do what he wanted to do. And when him and Jungle came to see me, they said, look, we just want to get our mom out the project.
That's
and
right.
I delivered him two checks and they were able to do that. And I'm very proud to say, you know, April 14th, 1994, when Illmatic came out, he sold 165,000 albums first week. He was a millionaire and he never looked back. He's never had an unrecouped week in his life.
That's what's up, yeah.
And were you ever like schooled in the game by anybody else in the industry that helped you acquire this knowledge to guide all of these individuals and be as successful as you were when that started happening for you?
You know, the funny thing is, brother, like, I don't see myself as the success. I see my success based on the success that the other artists had. Like, as much as I love putting together Word Life, I let O down. Like, I didn't deliver for him. And I hope, my hope is that I'm able to help him in another way, in different ways. I don't know how yet, but I'm figuring that out. Nas was easy because it was one of these situations where he already was feeling some type of way about the deal he already had presented in front of him. And it was me just making sure that he didn't sign the exact same deal that I was presented in 1987.
Right. Okay.
Wow.
Like, okay, it's 1993 and they were offering him the same exact bullshit deal. Like, it was easy to say, don't sign that. Like, I can make this better. And I'm very thankful that I did have a great lawyer. Shout out to Gary Baddeley.
Okay.
Shout out to my man Sake. Like, we had people around me at that time that we knew what a better deal looked like. And we knew what a better deal felt like. And we went in asking the right questions. But the other things, and Marley, I'm sure you can appreciate this. Like, I could not go into the studio and help Nas write a rhyme, but I damn sure could be behind the scenes to make sure that every sample got cleared. Right. So he never had a sample clearance issue and he never lost a penny in publishing or writer share because he had a cease and desist or a sample issue. Like, I made sure like every single sample got cleared.
Yeah.
Especially during that era.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you, Marley. I don't know if, well, I'm sure you don't know, Search, but I'm going to bring it up. Marley actually did a remix for Third Base.
I was in the studio. What are you talking about?
Oh,
I was
there. Yeah, was there. Oh, it was
a Product of the Environment remix.
Soar in every neighborhood. Look around and see all the young hoods. Kids will always be making bids, so you can't prevent being a product
of the environment.
The environment. There it is. Back and back.
And I'm proud to say that we all chipped in on that record. So, like, Marley brought the beat, but then my other partner brought a drum loop, and then I brought a little something, and then Daddy Rich. Like, that was a collaborative effort. Like, Product of the Environment remix was better than the original. Like, that's my favorite version of that Product of the Environment. That record was amazing. It was amazing.
The funny thing about that is that the original sample I used on a Collie joint, that we made it, but it didn't really go nowhere. So I was like, yo, let me flip this over there. So I brought that to your session and blah, it became a remix.
Yeah, it was amazing. And that's still like, even the Product of the Environment remix video, like being able to go back to Red Fern and seeing people from our hood and tell them, yo, Marley did this. Like they were bugging. Like if you watch the video, you see my whole hood up on the fences. Like while I'm on, like, it was like, everybody was so amped that like, I came back to the hood. And then Marley, like Marley Maul, like the Marley Maul did the remix.
Right.
Came back with a Marley banger. And Marley Maul remix Singer Love.
Yeah, so, a banger.
So
and repping Far Rockaway to the fullest on our record.
Legendized.
That's real talk.
Oh, so y'all had Def Jam in common.
Oh yeah.
All day.
Yeah.
All day.
Yeah. And y'all both have like no royalties from Def Jam in common.
All day. Same facto. Same facto.
Well, I must say, I mean, I don't know if we doing a lot of clearances, but I can't really say. You're right. I can't really say I ever seen a Def Jam royalty. I got to call LL and see what the fuck going on up in here.
Yeah, I know Search has, I've seen some other interviews and Search just confirmed he hasn't seen nothing either.
Wow.
Nah, it wasn't until Drink Champs that I even saw a royalty statement, and they're still claiming I'm unrecouped, which is crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, so it's just like, yo, how can I be unrecouped? I sold almost 1 million records and I'm unrecouped $100,000.
Yes.
Like, it's fucking, it's crazy. But that's Left Hand Records. I mean, Def Jam Records.
Oh, there you go.
You know what I mean? Like, that's just what it is. That's just what it is. I signed a left-handed deal, but, and I say this all the time as well, if it wasn't for that, I would not be here talking to y'all. So there's dues that had to be paid.
Right. And it's not in vain because of your experience. You're able to do things like, you know, help with the Nas situation and even further yourself and just do bigger things. Like, you did a jump to radio.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Radio. I mean, I was just, you know, I was one of these people that just, I have a big personality, and I was doing radio interviews, and then just people started saying to me, hey, are you interested in doing like radio? And then I was working records at radio, and more people were bringing me into the studio when I was working records. And a guy named Doc Winter, who runs the urban department for Clear Channel, now iHeart, said, hey, we want you to do a radio show in Virginia. And that led me to doing mornings in Detroit. And that led me to doing afternoons in Miami. And that led to, you know, a syndicated radio show. And, you know, I just, you know, for me, it's always been like about growth. And, you know, instead of doing one thing really good, I wanted to do a lot of things really well.
Got you. You know? You did the White Rapper show too. How did that come about?
That was Ego Trip, and that was like those guys, it was their idea. They just asked me to come in and host it, and it was a lot of fun, man. It was like, you know, it was a social experiment to see how far hip-hop had come from 1520 Sedgwick to, you know, these white MCs, and, you know.
Beata.
Yep. So there was Beata. Well, that was Miss Rap Supreme. That was Beata, and that was the other second season of the female rappers. But the white rappers, that was Persia and John Brown and Hallelujah, Hollaback. Okay. And, you know, it's crazy how many people, you know, remember that stuff.
You know, it's kind of historic.
It's part of the culture, man. That's real.
Yeah, without question.
As you progress and became more diversified in hip hop, did people come to you for opinions on other white rappers? And I'm gonna give two extremes, like Vanilla Ice all the way to like Eminem, then to like Mac Miller. Talk to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I think it's really obvious. I'd actually love to know Marley's opinion on this, because when we heard Ice Baby, I will never forget this. I was with Zev Love X, AKA M of Doom, may he rest in peace. DJ Sub Rock, may he rest in peace, and my old partner. And the first time we heard that record, we were in Ontario. We were in Texas. We heard the record, and doom, 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 doom. We're like, oh, shit, okay. That's kind of dope. Wonder who's going to spit. And we heard Stop, Collaborate, and we went, oh, God. You could just tell it was a white boy. Like, you could just, there was no... And it sounded like he was trying to appropriate, and his inflection was terrible. But then, you know, us from the five boroughs, when Kane said, word to the mother, right? Like, that's just how you said it. And it was word to the motherland. Like, that's what word to the mother meant.
Word right? to the mother.
Mm-hmm. And then he ends his song, word to your mother. Like, the most appropriated craziness I ever heard. And then, so we were like, yo, this record's going to be a brick. Like, this is a straight brick.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on some crazy Japanese-sounding label, Fukiyaki Records, Kamikaze Records, some crazy shit. Like, I didn't even know who the label was. It was out of Atlanta, some wild shit. And this record starts to blow up. And all of a sudden, he signs to EMI, SBK, and the video comes out. Mm-hmm. And he's all in the dark, and then he comes out in the light, which is just like what we did 3 years earlier with Step Into the AM, where we're like doing all our shit, and then the hood comes off, it's the other man, pulling all our own shit out the fucking frame. And our whole thing was like, we were taught the culture. Not only taught the culture, we were given a pass to be allowed to be in the culture. That's how we saw it. This dude is selling records to white chicks who don't give a fuck about an Eazy-E, a Big Daddy Kane, a G-Rap, a Shantae, a Salt and Pepper, an Ultra Mag, a Kane. They don't give a fuck about an LL. I could go on and on. All they're seeing is MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice, and that's hip-hop. And that just was dead-ass wrong.
Wow.
So when we did Pop Goes the Weasel, we had to set that fucking record straight real fucking fast. Because what we did was, and the plan was with Pop Goes the Weasel, is that even if it didn't hit, it would have a pop enough sample where we would be able to get on pop radio and then tell pop radio who De La Soul was, who the Native Tongues were, who Tribe was, who Main Source was. Like, we could go in and we could say to the DJs, yo, fuck that dude. Play all of this. This is hip hop. Play Digital. Play Latifah. Play. We were. I mean, I had a Sir I Boo record in my fucking crate. Like, play this. This is hip hop. Play Lakim Shabazz.
Okay. Right.
Play Poor Righteous Teachers. Like, right. Yo, do you want a fucking list? Like, this is what you're playing?
Right.
So when.
So you had a little heavy burden.
Heavy burden. Yo, I had a battery on my back. Like, I felt like it was my responsibility. Okay. Like, as a white guy who got a pass, I felt like it was my responsibility to call out all fraudulent shit. Black, white, Asian, whatever it was. And I don't care if it alienated me or not, it was my responsibility. I was given the pass. It was also my challenge to also hold up the shield.
How did you feel when they outsold you?
Yo, it felt like fucking trash. But there was also, three stages of it, right? So I didn't care about the sales so much as long as the people around me knew I was real. That's A.
Gotcha.
B, while they were taking who they were taking on the road, we took Naughty by Nature and Cypress on their first national tour. We took Nice and Smooth on their first national tour. We were taking motherfuckers that we really thought needed to be heard on tour, right? That's B. Sales didn't bother me as much. It really didn't. At the end of the day, I knew I could make a living.
Didn't you think that they was reaching more people than your reach? If they coming out so corny and they're white boys and they selling way more records than you, you know, wouldn't you seem like a hater or something if you just start yapping about it? They outselling you, got bigger shows than you and doing better in the industry.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could see why we would look like haters, but I think we made it really clear that we were not haters because of what we represented. I mean, mm-hmm. I said, hip-hop got turned into hip-hop the second a record was number one on the pop chart, but don't skid on the heart that got a start in the ghetto, let no one forget about the hard parts. Now we got 91, mm-hmm. we got a new band, a new brand, looking like the same old clan. Same old thieves that skeeve, so we got to make sure the real rappers got to endure. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was trying to really put some finesse on that shit. Moving forward, you know, there was a period of time after Third Base, and even after my solo album, when, you know, we did Back to the Grill Again with Red Hot Love a Tone and Chubb Rock and obviously Nas, and I executive produced Illmatic. Every group that was successful all felt like they needed to have their own white rapper. It was like almost like a fucking pet dog. You know what I mean? Like, everybody felt like they needed a pet dog. Like, Naughty by Nature had Milkbone. And this one had JoJo Pellegrino. And this one had that one. And that one had that one. And this one had that one. And it was all good. And then Dre had M, right? Now, M was different. And I'll tell you why. M came after the Young Black Teenagers, which was a crazy... I don't know why Chuck D and they guys even tried to make that happen.
Okay. I was going to mention them, but I'm glad you did.
That's just the craziest shit ever. Like, white boys calling themselves Young Black Teenagers was crazy. But after that, you have fucking Dre puts out M. Now, this is the difference. And I want to be really clear about this. Mm-hmm. I was real cool with J. Dilla, may he rest in peace. And I was real cool with Detroit. Like, I knew dudes in Detroit. And obviously, I knew Breed. That was my man. So we heard about this kid who was rhyming and put out a record on Scam. This little record, this little white boy. And then he had this record called I Don't Give a Fuck. And he was dope. And he said, you know, I'm nice and impede. I'm on a search to crush a milk bone. And like, I was like, oh, this kid got wordplay. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then he did the record Bad Verse Evil with Royce the 5'9" on John Schechter's mm-hmm. label Game. And I'm like, okay, there might be a kid out here who's real. And then he obviously, you know, he did the Rap Olympics and fucking just was. And that's where I come from, because that's how I got signed. I was a battle MC and Russell heard me battle mm-hmm. and diss Marley's whole camp at World Seminar. And then that's when he signed me. So I was like, okay, I'm not going to be mad at this kid. Like, this kid is great.
Gotcha.
You know, he's amazing. And then I heard Slim Shady and I was like, yo, he's amazing. And I showed nothing but love to that kid from the door. And then as you move forward, you know, even when you talk about Mac Miller, may he rest in peace. Like, I loved Mac. I loved Mac because Mac wasn't a battle MC. Mac to me was the last of the great white hopes when it comes to just wanting to be heard, you know? Mm-hmm. And he, for me, is the first and the last to come from this SoundCloud era where it was just about music. He didn't talk about being white. He didn't talk about being blah, blah, blah. He just made fucking great music. And, you know, he doesn't sound like anyone. It's not like how Action Bronson sounds like Ghost, or how this one has, you know,
right,
this kind of inflection, or this one. Like, Mac sounded like Mac, you know? You know, so
real talk.
You know, so that's kind of my opinion about it. And you know, with the Beastie Boys and our beef with the Beastie Boys, like, and all of that, like, it wasn't that I calmed down. It's just that my voice wasn't as important. As I moved on and as my records became less and less hot, I became less and less valuable as a voice of credibility to the culture. And it took other people to make amazing records to take that on.
But you were still doing a lot behind the scenes.
Yeah, but that's my responsibility, right? Like, that's the responsibility of an executive, is to learn from your mistakes and not allow artists that you fuck with to get sucked into making the same mistakes twice.
Legendize.
This is the story of how a film gets made. Starring Josh Rubin.
It's his first feature.
You Were the Worst's Aya Cash.
Can we not do this right now?
Oh. And SNL's Chris Redd.
He's not doing it for a paycheck.
Okay, I'll see y'all.
Join us for the making of Scare Me, a horror comedy from the brilliant mind of Josh Rubin.
This year you're gonna make a movie no matter what.
Tear down the fourth wall of filmmaking with our crack team of investigators.
Don't you come at me and try to get me to spill some stuff.
This is Make Cool Shit, hosted by Aaron Hayfetz.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Season 1, Make a Movie.
3, 2, 1.
Everywhere you enjoy podcasts.
So I guess I'm going to learn the film business.
Legendize.
So explain to me something. I'm hearing a lot that you was really close with Jam Master Jay.
Yeah.
So what's the relationship between you and Jay? How'd that pop?
I was stressing Grand Wizard Tony D from the Bad Boys, who had a big record called Inspector Gadget.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Bow, 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 bow.
With the upper hand, the other MCs, they can't understand that Mr. Mack is not your average man, because I can hypnotize your body.
And I was stressing him and stressing him and stressing him and stressing him and stressing him. You know, and then he put out, "Oh, Veronica, Veronica, oh, Veronica, girl."
Right, right, exactly, with the beatbox,
right,
too.
Right.
Oh, Veronica, Veronica, oh, Veronica, girl.
She's so sexy, so fucking the next feature. She got robes and stuff.
Right, and then he put out the Glamour Girls, you know, right, that Magic dated Glamorous for a minute, and finally he let me. He finally, after like 6 months of calling this dude almost every day, Grand Wizard Tony D invited me to his house in Seagate, and when I went to his house, I knocked on the door. He let me in, and there was Grandmaster D from Houdini and Jam Master Jay.
Oh, wow.
And this kid, wow, Lord Taru, who I went to high school with. And they took me into the basement. And I remember going into the basement going, man, I'm about to get robbed by three of the greatest DJs of all time.
Wow.
Like,
wow,
this is incredible. This is going to be a great story. Wow. And I'd never seen a studio before. I'd never seen, like, especially not a makeshift studio. And they turned on a little light and they sat me down. And Jay was right in front of me, and Grandmaster D was to my left, and Tony D was to my right.
Wow.
And Tony pointed me and told me to rap. And I rapped my ass off 2 minutes straight, like just rapping my ass off. And then there was silence, dead silence. And Grandmaster J leaned back with that heavy laugh and that sigh, and he said, man, if white boys start rhyming like this, we're finished. Yo, I need you to come on the road with me. I need you to go on tour. And he took me on the road, and Grandmaster D was like, no, I need this kid to write. I need, you know, you need to come to Ecstasy's house. We're working on the song. Yeah? And Tony D was like, no, he came to see me. This is my artist. I'm signing him, and I'm signing MC Searching. Yeah? And that's and that's how Jay and I built our relationship. And he was such an important part of my life. Every record, almost every decision I ever made, I ran it past Jay. Like, I'd go to the studio with him. I play ball with him, you know, like in my loft where I do my podcast, there's a picture of his chain Jonathan Mannion took of the chain that he was buried in. And right above that is his wake information, like the pamphlet that was
passed out
at his wake. So yeah, man, Jay is he's a part of my life. He stays with me everywhere I go.
Legendize.
I'm a fan of hip hop. And to hear your background history and to hear your story and how you've been in the presence of greatness and legends who weren't back then, who are now, and your attachments to different facets in hip hop, it's amazing.
Especially coming from music and art.
Yeah.
And witnessing what you're seeing over there.
And I want to just ask you, because you did mention that you were going to sign a contract to go to school in St. Louis. What were you planning on doing with music if it wasn't hip hop?
I was studying voice. I was literally, my plan was to be a cantor or a rabbi. And I didn't have enough money to go to yeshiva because, you know, that it was real expensive for my parents.
Yes.
So
okay.
My plan was I was going to go and study opera. I went to music and art. That's what I studied, opera. So I was going to go to St. Louis and basically tune my voice and, you know, then go to cantorial school.
And you never hit one note in the booth? Never ever hit a note?
I did, actually. At the end of Words of Wisdom, I sing an Italian opera.
That's you?
Yeah.
Oh, yo. Talk to us about your podcast or something that you've been doing most recent.
Well, I mean, we have a joint venture. Me and my wife have a company called the Timeless Podcast Company. And our philosophy is that we're going to start telling the stories of our legends, but in a way that we believe they need to be told, not just in the audio form, but just in full surround sound. So I studied about a year and understanding how drivers work and headphones and doing full surround sound and just trying to figure out, you know, how I could capture full organic surround sound in headphones and podcasting. So we created Immersive Sound Design. The first season of our show was called Did I Ever Tell You the One About Big Daddy Kane? It debuted and premiered on the Apple Podcast, top 5 in full surround sound. Listen, one of my favorite stories, Marley, is how Kane told me on the podcast how he came to your crib to drop off lyrics for Biz. And you were like, yo, you rhyme? And you were like, yeah, I rhyme. And he rhymed something. And you were like, come in the house. Let me hear what you got. And that's how you guys wound up doing Raw.
He didn't tell you that I was holding heat behind the door because I didn't know who the fuck he was.
Legendize.
We have 3 other shows we're launching. The Search Says podcast. Breaking Anonymity podcast, which is all about recovery, and Line for Line, which is going to be a really special show. So we have that, and then we have our 4MC distribution company. So we're distributing artists, and I'm also the chief consultant, creative consultant for a new social platform called VidSig. So brothers like Marley Marl could actually make money talking to artists. It's a one-on-one social platform. So we hooked up with Joe Montana, Jerry Rice, April Walker, Domingo, and all these people get to talk to their fans one-on-one, and you can set your own price to talk to your people.
Okay, dope.
What was the last time you actually performed a live show?
It was just before the pandemic. I performed at Russell Wilson's golf tournament in Seattle. So I performed for Russell's event. And then usually I perform every year at an event called Monday After the Masters, which is an event that Hootie and the Blowfish do in Myrtle Beach, North Carolina. Darius Rucker is a huge, huge fan of mine. He has been for years. So he'll have me come up there every year and perform. And it was so funny because the people that were doing the background vocals for Pop Goes the Weasel was like Joey Fatone from NSYNC, Darius Rucker, and the guy from Stained. like Aaron Lewis. And the guy who was doing my old partner's verses was Nate from Boyz II Men. So like we have a good time. We go up there, bug out. We have a good time. Oh, wow. And then I'll surprise Darius with like, because Darius, he's like a real old school hip hop junkie. He loves that. So I surprised him one year and had Chubb Rock. It's a really funny, if you look on Instagram and social, when Chubb came out and did and Treat Him Right, before we're pulling him off stage, Darius comes out and he goes, yo, you can't leave. I got to tell you, you know, my favorite line you ever said was, she got all Vanessa Del Rio on me. You know, like he started reciting his lyrics. And might be going back on the road. I'm putting a new group together now called the Co-Defendants. So we're in the studio. I'm working on my first album for the first time in like 27 years.
All hip hop.
Yeah, but like going back to a lot of what I started out doing, which is like a real combination of like alternative, but hip hop. This group comprised of Brett Epignazer. It's my man Brockett, the Rocket, who has been Lady Gaga's keyboard player for like 20 years. And Johnny Marr, who is the lead guitarist from a band called The Smiths, who did The Gorillaz and Modest Mouse and all of that. So it's kind of like a rock, but it's all hip hop. It's like real shit. But
and what made you decide to get back into it with a new group? Like
yeah, no, it's a great question. Like I found out that Johnny Marr was a fan, and I'm a huge fan of The Smiths. In fact, my wife's favorite group ever is The Smiths. I found out through friends that he was a huge fan. And we started building a friendship over the last 2 years.
Okay.
And he started playing me things that he's working on for his new project and all of that. And I started letting him hear some rhymes. And he was like, you know, you sound inspired. And I was like, do I sound inspired? Like, do I really? He's like, no. He's like, yo, he's like, I'm telling you from like, you sound inspired. As he was saying that, my man Brockett sent me some beats. Like Brockett's the kind of musician. And I know Marley can appreciate this because he messes with so Brock is the kind of musician that
a white boy with his hair all over the place.
Yeah, Brockett Parsons. Yeah. So So this is the kind. So he created the first. He has the first like 360 degree piano. Like he created, he invented this piano. It's crazy. So you can start spitting things over the phone, and all of a sudden he just starts making music. Like he's just a naturally born, like this dude, you know, whatever the Most High put in him was music.
Mm-hmm.
He just started sending me some music. So he sent me this track. I said, you know what? Let me send it to Johnny. Let me just see what he thinks. I was like, Johnny, fuck with this. Figuring this is Johnny Marr. Like this is, you know, Gorillaz. This is Modest Mouse. This dude is like working on soundtracks with like, you know, for the James Bond movies. Like, you know, who am I? Like, I'm just, this, right. You know, I'm MC Search from like whatever. 24 hours later, he sent me this track. It was crazy. And then 24 hours later, he sent me another track. And then, so now I'm sitting on all these tracks and I'm like, okay, it's time to go. So we started to go. Yes, I started working on tracks. And actually, the funny thing is the genesis of it really was Ebro at Hot 97. Last Hanukkah, just before the pandemic, was talking about Hanukkah. And was talking about all the Jews in hip-hop who never made Hanukkah song. And he mentioned Drake and Mac Miller, rest in peace, and Action Bronson. But then he pauses and he goes, you know who's the Jewiest, most Jewy, Jew, mega Jew, rabbi Jew rapper of all time is MC Search. That dude never made a Hanukkah song. And I said, it is on. So I wrote a song called Sean Bright, which is not, as much as I love being Jewish is kind of corny. Like, it's corny. Like, if you think about, like, it's not as cool. Like, all the great Christmas songs are written by Jews. Irving Berlin, like, you know, Silent Night. It's all, why? Because Hanukkah shit is kind of corny. So I was like, how am I going to make a cool song which everybody would love? So I wrote this song, which is it's about shining. It's about stay lit, shine bright. So I got like Boyz II Men to sing on the chorus, and I got Darius Rucker to sing on the chorus. I got Matis Yahoo. Like I got all these people on the record.
Oh, hello, you say Matis Yahoo.
Well, not yet. I shouldn't say that yet. Not yet.
Okay.
But I'm getting a lot of people on it. And then my whole idea is every year is going to have a remix. So I have other people jump on, jump off, jump on. So that led to really making the album.
What started as a little seed.
Became a Hanukkah bush.
All right. And then now there's a talk of you actually touring.
honestly, like, you know, I've come to the realization and the acceptance that people don't want to see an MC Search show. They want to see a full band show, but that ain't never going to happen. So if I create something new, great. And if people want to see me, great. And if they don't, great.
Motherfuckers want to see Third Base, my nigga.
Yeah, and that's never going to happen. And I'm okay with that. But that can't happen. Like, it's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
Right.
Hold up. What about a celebrity boxing match with you and you the Third Base celebrity boxing match?
No, I have no reason. Like, I'm not. Come on, man. Stop that. That's the corniest shit ever. Like, I'm never doing that shit. Like, I'm not going to play myself either. Like, let's be clear.
Is there any advice that you were given along your road that has stuck with you that you could share with us and for others out there who are listening?
Yeah, I think the one piece of advice that I wish I would have listened to more of is something my wife says all the time. Michael, say what you mean and mean what you say. You know, we get into hustle mode sometimes in this business. And a lot of people do. You know, you want to impress somebody or you want to impose on them how important you are, or you want to feel like you need to overwhelm them with information and get them to be convinced because you're trying to control whatever environment you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So she used to tell me to say what you mean and mean what you say. And I didn't understand what that meant until like recently, until I started to peel back the onion and get to know my own self a little better. So that's one. Say what you mean and mean what you say, which means whatever you say, stand by. And if you are not going to stand by it, don't fucking say it. Keep your mouth shut.
Right.
Say what you mean and mean what you say. If I say I'm going to do this podcast and I do it, if I'm not going to do it, then I'm not going to do it.
Mm.
If I say to Marley, send me a beat, I'm going to listen to it, then I'm going to listen to it.
No doubt.
If you reach out to me on VidSig and you say, yo, I want to schedule something, I'm going to do it. But the other one, and this is, I think, even more important than the first one, because I don't think it gets said enough. How you do anything is how you do everything.
Mm.
And I never really understood what that meant either. How you do anything is how you do everything. Because there's a lot of things I do that I don't even think about, right?
Okay.
But if I flippantly throw away something that has value, then more than likely, I'm going to consider someone who has value as less than, because I just treat shit like shit.
Mm.
If I throw garbage out the window, then more than likely, I probably disrespect the planet. I'm not thinking about the environment. I'm not thinking about other people. I'm just being selfish. How you do anything is how you do everything.
No doubt.
And think about that for a second. If you're a creative or if you're a loving person, then you love everything. If you're a thoughtful person, then you're thoughtful in everything you do. How you do anything is how you do everything. So I think those are the two things that I would love to kind of impart on people who are younger. Say what you mean what you say, and how you do anything is how you do everything.
Legendize.
We know that, you know, your time is very valuable with all the entities that you were involved in. We just thank you.
I got one question to ask you. Did you ever find out why Eric B was mad at you, bro?
Yo, I still don't know why Eric's mad at me. I have no idea. Like, I really don't know. Like, that was my man. Like, the first Eric B for President record, he was wearing a white bubble with a fur collar. He walked into the quarters and handed me the record on Zakiya. Before it was Zakiya and 4th and Broadway, Zakiya Records, Eric B for President.
Right.
I used to drive him out to Wine Dance to see some chick. Like, that was my man. And then I heard he was mad at me, and we ain't spoken in like 30 years. Like, I don't know what it is, but I don't know why he's mad at me. I'd love to know why.
Same here. I don't know what it is.
I don't know what it is, but he does not fuck with me. But I love Eric. And if you're watching this, Eric, I love you, bro. Like, you know, let's not let any water pass under the bridge anymore, man. Get at me. Like, let's talk. I fuck with you.
That's what's up. All right, well,
I got one question. I got one question for Marley.
What's up?
If you had to pick two songs that were your favorite produced songs of all time, which ones are they and why?
That I made?
Yes, sir.
I'm always going to go with Around the Way Girl, because it's like a special song to me. It was like, Rising to the Top, Kenny Burke. It was like a Queen's anthem. You're talking about the chicks at the sucking on a lollipop at the bus stop. I mean, that's one of my favorite joints. I gotta say, the second one has to be Make the Music with Your Mouth Biz. I mean, that one, that's a classic. It's been sampled a lot. And it's also resampled on this new Mariah Carey and Ghostface remix I just did. So that's one of my favorites too, right? Those are my two favorites of all times. Those are not the biggest publishing makers, but those are my favorite.
No, it's never about money. It's about opportunity, right? Like you make records because they establish a sense of opportunity and they established a sense of, you know, being. But did you produce It's a Demo and I'm Fly for G-Rap and Polo?
Yeah.
Dude, I just named my two favorite Marley records that you ever produced. Let me tell you something. When I heard G-Rap say he was rolling down the one-way street the wrong way, and he said, rolling up my tinted window, raise my antenna, because I'm not only fly, but I'm a big breadwinner. I threw every rhyme book I had. That shit was wrong. And when I heard people in the audience, Cool G Rap is my name. I write rhymes and insert it inside your brain. And T.J. Pillow, the man behind me, operates the turntables when I'm rocking around because it's a demo. It's a demo.
Give it demo. It's a demo. It's a demo. It's a demo. Just, and it kept on going at the end of the record. It's a demo. It's a demo. It's a demo. It's a demo.
Incredible. Incredible. Thank you, Marley. Thank you for that. Thank you.
No doubt.
Thank you.
So, Search, in your podcast, as you're talking about, you know, legends, we want to honor those who we feel are legends while they're here. So you are currently being what, Marley?
Legendized.
Thank you, guys. No doubt. And listen, it's such an honor to do this with Marley and you guys. And thank you guys both so much for having me on.
Yo, Search, keep doing what you're doing. And I know that we're going to reconnect. And until we do, stay blessed. I'm speaking on behalf of hip hop fans. You know, we really appreciate you. That's real talk.
Thank you, man. Stay legendized, gentlemen.
No doubt. Peace.
I just gotta say on this podcast, you know it's corny as hell when motherfuckers send you a message and put the muscle arm and they be putting like long ass shit starting with the muscle arm. Like, come on, that shit is corny as hell, man. Would y'all quit that bullshit out? Fingers, the black power.
You wanna talk about grown men who use emojis?
Yeah. Y'all killing me with these emojis.
Grown men?
Yeah, grown men putting up the fucking muscle arm. You know your arm don't look like that. No, goddamn well, that's not your arm. Fuck is that muscle shit for, man?
Legendized.